Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to the show, made possible, as always, by our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. And today, we're joined by an AFL star of the West. Paul Hazelby played 208 games for the Fremantle Dockers, an 11-year career that saw him win the Rising Star, earn All-Australian honours, and represent his country in the International Rules Series. He's a four-time Ross Glendinning medalist, a Fremantle Life member, and the former midfielder is a big voice in the media these days, but also down the years has used his profile to do some amazing work in the suicide prevention space. Paul, it's a great pleasure to have you on, mate. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Sammy.
And you're yet another one, we should point out right off the top, from Northampton, this small town, some 470-odd clicks north of Perth, and a grossly underrated, I'm going to call it a footy factory, Hayes. At least it's underrated out here on the East Coast.
A best recruiting ground in the world for AFL players. There's a population of only 800 in Northampton, so if you move there, you've got a pretty strong chance of getting picked up. And funny enough, in recent times, because there has been so many, it's become a tourist attraction that we got some statues erected in front of a big mural. And I often get photos of, you know, former teammates and supporters that are going past, taking the photos on their way up north, because it has been the home of so many great players. And very fortunate that I think we all had one or two, you know, 2 or 3 years ahead of us to give us something to aim for. And Andrew Lockie was the first one, and then Daniel Chick. And then it was Tarkin Lockie who went to Collingwood, myself, Josh Kennedy, Harry Taylor, Patrick Cripps, Jamie Cripps, Liam Anthony, and also Bryn Teagle. And I guess the crazy thing is that when it's all said and done, of the 9 or 10 that have played AFL, there's going to be 7 200 gamers and maybe 6 250 gamers. It's unbelievable. Coleman medal winner in Kennedy and a Brownlow medal winner in Patrick Cripps.
So you must have been asked about this many times, but what's the theory here? I mean, is it just because you've always had something? You're going to have something to aspire to. It's another thing doing it. For a small population, to have 10 players or whatever it is make the grade is an extraordinary ratio.
The old gag is it was a lead mining town, so there was high levels of lead found in the water about 10 years ago. But I think, in all honesty, it's because we saw that pathway, because there was one, and we all went through the East Fremantle Football Club. You know, you could believe it. And when you can see something and talk to those people, for me, it was Andrew Lockyer. I remember going down and watching him with my old man, who was friends with him as a 12-year-old at East Fremantle. And I think just the country lifestyle in those days, my whole life was built on being at a sporting club Saturday, Sunday, you know, Friday and Thursday, whether that be basketball, tennis. My parents had a huge involvement in tennis and footy. That was what you did, and it gave you a lot of time to try and work on your craft.
And the statue, are you happy with how you've been immortalised?
Yeah, very happy with that one. I got to pick it out, and my mum was on the committee to try and make that happen. So, of course, I had to look good.
Jeez, unbelievable. You're not up there now, of course. You're down in Perth, and you're a big part of the SEN stable these days, the Sports and Entertainment Network. How are you finding it?
Yeah, loving it. It takes a bit of time when your career finishes. And for me, when I was playing, it was always between, do I go into coaching or do I go into media? And I think the last 3 or 4 years, I spent a lot of time trying to work on both. And first and foremost, I went into coaching. I was the head coach of South Fremantle Football Club and did that for 3 years, but didn't have that real passion and drive to take it further. And then sort of fell in, really, to the media job. Got a call from Hutchie after I just finished up with the women's team in the first year of the AFLW competition to say, mate, we're looking for somebody to replace Brad Hardy, which was big shoes to fill over here in the West at that time. And that came with a lot of disappointment for some regular listeners of the station at the time. But I've always given my opinion. I've always been honest and like to believe I'm very impartial, whether talking about Freo or West Coast.
I love it that you're a straight shooter. And hey, we're talking at a time where, look, footy is as alive and well in the West as it's been for some time. We're speaking after an incredible derby. So Freo having a down moment now, just having lost that and are far from perfect. But they've shown some signs this year. And then the Eagles just won two games in a row for the first time since 2021.
Yeah, it's been a resurrection. We've been dead for 3 years over here in the West, although Fremantle a couple of years ago were pretty good. But that's what you want to see. Like, you look at GWS and Sydney right now. It's so exciting for the state of Western Australia when you have that rivalry going that way. And I think for the first time in the Derby for a long time, the result wasn't the expected result, because West Coast won 11 in a row, then Fremantle won 5 in a row. I think for the rivalry to continue to build, you need those upsets. But footy and media is a lot better when you have your teams flying.
We've all been amazed by the levels and the depth of the Harley Reid hype. I'm not sure how many back and front pages are up to now in the West Oz. It might be north of 50. The mock contract extension was drawn up in Monday's edition. As someone, I guess, Hayes, who has lived being a high draft pick in Perth, what have you made of it with Harley Reid?
I thought it was out of control, really, and irresponsible to start with. Like, he's an 18-year-old kid, and you know, he came into the system and he dominated the under-18s comp, but it doesn't always translate. And I think through the first three or four rounds, I was probably sitting back going, wow, okay, the kid's got a few tricks, but then the last 3 weeks, he's actually exploded. And look, I'd say we're up to 60 or 70, and if you look at today's paper, you know, again, it would have references to Harley Reid, I reckon, 8 or 9 times. There's a back page, and then there's another Harley Mania back page on top of that. Now, you know, what he's shown over the last 3 weeks, he's going to be a terrific player. But I think you've got to be a bit cautious with it, with the way that you approach young people, because we've seen, particularly in this state, many people go through the highs and lows of an AFL career. But right now, it's all high for him. But I have thought it's got it going a bit too far at times.
It's a good point you make, because I guess the pressure is real, isn't it? Like, and good on him, all the more power to him at the moment. But the anxiety that veterans feel to perform, let alone teenagers, and to do it all in the face of all that. I mean, we're dealing with at the moment, like a mentally tough kid, aren't we?
Yeah, and the AFL competition is hard, and it really finds a way to bring down those gun young players. You go through Matt Rowe's first 3 games. I don't know about you, but I was sitting back going, wow, this kid's going to win 3 Brownlows. And then it was Nick Dacos last year. And then all of a sudden those two, you know, I've had some patches that they've had to work through. And whether it be tagging or just the opposition putting more time into those players, to be an elite player and to overcome all that, you've got to be extraordinary at what you do. And that's the challenge for him going forward.
And he's the sexy story, as we say in the industry, isn't he? And he always was going to be as a number one pick coming in and all the hype around him. But geez, some of the old timers over there for the West Coast are playing some great footy. It feels like they've been dead for a while. Like Yo, Kelly, McGovern, Abaris, Waterman's kicking goals. They've played such little footy of late. They're fit and firing, and that all fits into it all as well in terms of, I imagine, helping Harley Reid as much as he's helped them.
And that's what I don't like to see with all the mania around Harley Reid, is that the guys that have come back and put in some hard yards, like Jake Waterman, his story in itself, and he's been enormous, probably been better over the last 2 weeks than what Harley Reid has for that football club. You could apply that to Elliot Yeo. McGovern, Darling had some moments as well. Cripps, so those old guys that have done it pretty tough for 2 years, all of a sudden they're playing their role and playing some good footy, but they don't get much emotion around that from the general media and public. And I don't think that's fair, but Harley himself, he has brought a lot to that football club, and all of a sudden I think they're all feeding off that and growing together.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey. It's all thanks to Tobin Brothers, a family-owned business since 1934. So from small-town WA all the way to the AFL's bright lights, we'll retrace Paul Hazelby's early steps after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, it's great to have your company on This Is Your Journey, made possible by Tobin Brothers Funeral Celebrating Lives. We're with Fremantle Dockers great Paul Hazelby. So, Hayes, you're born June 12th, 1981, Geraldton. What are your earliest memories of childhood? What was it like growing up in country WA?
Well, I was a townie, so my parents have the hardware store. Hazelby's Hardware, it was called back in the day, but they've since sold that. But a lot of my friends were farmers, so I spent a lot of time on farms, whether it would be shooting something, whether it would be trying to catch birds or catch yabbies or kunaks in the dams that existed. I was always doing something in the outdoors, along with playing sport at that particular time, that gave me such a great childhood.
So a lot of freedom?
A lot of freedom, yep. In the town, do whatever you want. But, of course, to get to the farms, you needed some transport. So it wasn't always easy to get to those places because they were kilometres away back in those days.
Get on your pushy, Hayes. Get on your pushy.
Well, pushies and riding motorbikes, that was a big part of my childhood.
Siblings?
Yes, two older brothers and an older sister. So I was the youngest of four. And we all got sent away to boarding school. I got sent at the age of 13, I think it was back then, year eight. And that was following my brothers down to Perth. And it was a big sacrifice at the time for my parents because all of my friends actually went to school in Geraldton. Someone went to boarding school there. But I think Mum and Dad worked out pretty early that sport was going to be my go. I wasn't the best student. So sport, to give me the best chance to go to Perth and, you know, work on my skills and, you know, in the better competitions around the state, that's the sacrifice they made from a young age.
Sacrifice for them, but, I mean, this is, what, this is Mazenod College, you're 13 years of age or thereabouts. So is it, was that daunting? Like, can you take yourself back to remember the, any sort of feeling of anxiety of moving a long way away from home at that age, or were you just like, let me out of here, let's have at it?
No, I had my brother there, so one was there at the time, but I got, you know, I was homesick. I used to cry just about every time. For the first 12 months, every time Mum and Dad would drop you back up to the boarding school. So it was this real eerie feeling. I still drive up the hill here in Perth, and I get that same feeling that I had all those years ago. But I was pretty lucky. I played cricket as soon as I got to the school, and I was lucky enough to play in the year nine competition in the first week or two that I was there, and I scored 100 on debut. So instantly you sort of made a few friends around the traps, which made it a little bit easier.
I love it. With the footy though, and this is probably going back to Northampton, what initially drew you to the game that would be, you know, that would obviously become your career and your life? What lit the spark there?
Well, it was the local heroes that you grow up watching, that you just wanted to do that. When I was growing up, it was like, I just want to play for Northampton in the league team because of those big names that I'd watched. I never got to see my old man play, but that was the path that he took. And my brother was a pretty good footballer too, and he actually represented East Fremantle. He was 4 years older than me. He went through the Colt system. So I think trying to follow his footsteps, but also that of the superstars that I remember from Northampton.
Who'd you barrack for?
I was an Eagles supporter in the early days, and I had the chance. When I got drafted in the AFL, there was a rule back then that each club could take one 17-year-old. So I put my name in the draft as a 17-year-old, and the West Coast Eagles had a bit of banter with my old man, suggesting that they were going to take me with pick 53, I think it was, at the time. And Andrew Emily was expected to be already taken.
Yeah.
He didn't go, and the recruiters of West Coast actually said, look, to Mick Malthouse, we can't split Hazelby and Embley. And Mick said, OK, we'll go with Embley because he's taller. So they end up taking him. I then miss out, go back to East Fremantle, have a good year in the seniors, and then get picked up the following season.
So with the and we all take footy up for fun as kids. That's the whole point of it. Otherwise, we wouldn't bother. But when did you or others on your behalf think, you know, hang on, I might have something here?
Yeah, about the age of 15. So you're starting to enter some of those pathways, the state programs, played in them, went pretty well. And then you're looking sort of 2 and 3 years ahead to say, well, the best players 2 years ago are now in that position where they're getting close to being drafted. So that was when, you know, the spark was ignited for me. And then I think missing out on that draft actually helped me. I went back, had a full season playing against men for East Fremantle in the seniors. And then by that stage, I was ready. I was mature enough to get picked up in that 99 draft.
Yeah, so just on that, you're playing for East Fremantle on the Waffle. I think you only turned 18 in the middle of that season playing against men. I mean, was it a baptism of fire looking back, Hayes, or the logical step?
No, at the time, I loved it, and I had a bit of success. I was fortunate enough to win the best and fairest that year with East Fremantle as an 18-year-old. And within that, I had to play the under-18s carnival as well that year. So it all really happened very fast. I went from Colts footy, all of a sudden you've jumped up and you're playing league football. But at that stage, you know, we had such a good team. Earl Spalding was there, his brother, Rhett Bowden, some guys that I'd really, you know, admired from afar through the Waffle competition that took me under their wing And by the end of that season, I had a great belief that I was ready for the AFL competition.
The Duke of Earl, I love it. So you represented WA at under 16 level, under 18 level, as you mentioned. Lark medal for best player in that 99 under 18 carnival as well. Who else was in that WA team, Hayes? Because you won the title that year from memory.
Yeah, so we had 2 years where we were pretty good. I think the year before, Des Headland and Justin Longmuir, Andrew Embley, those sort of types got picked up. Then it was Darren Glass. Leon Davis was also picked up. Brett Johnson, who went to Carlton and Hawthorn, he was our captain of that team. Chance Bateman was included. So there was a number of good players. We had seven, I think, that were that did get drafted from that team that year, and we were fortunate enough to win the competition, which I think was the first time in a long time that we were able to beat the Vics.
Yeah, gee, there was some talent on that team, though. But what gave you, just coming back to you, what gave you the most joy in the game then as a kid and as a professional? Was there a constant all the way through?
Oh, I think just the challenge. I think just finding the footy and trying to bring teammates into the game was my go, whether that be setting them up with a shot on goal, or I love trying to do the stuff on the inside, like the midfield craft, to bring the other players on the outside with a quick handball or something like that. And my first year was a baptism of fire. I got the pleasure of playing on guys like Michael Voss, Mark Ricciuto, Ben Cousins, like head-to-head on those guys at that stage before tagging really took off again. And I used to love it. Like they would have good games. They'd, you know, finish their day being best player for their club, and I'd find a fair bit of footy as well. I think Gary Hocking in my first game, I had the privilege to play on him. So it was when you had those great battles against those individuals in that era of football.
So just coming back to that East Fremantle year after, you know, West Coast as a destination sort of came and went, just by the second half of this next year, it was commonly known you were going to go early in the draft. So how aware were you of the AFL landscape? Who was going poorly and whatnot? Did you find yourself playing hypotheticals on a weekly basis? Because, you know, your life and your career depended on it.
Yeah, I did, but it was pretty easy because Fremantle had picks 2, 4, and 5.
Yeah, that's outrageous.
That year. So, you know, and Josh Fraser, who went number one from Collingwood, was always the selected number one from a long way out as well. And then in between, you had Richmond. I think they took Aaron Fiora, and then Matthew Pavlich went to the Fremantle Dockers at 4, and Lee Brown, of course, at 5. I think the Dockers had Pav ahead of me, but they knew that Richmond wanted a midfielder. So they had the luxury of taking me at 2, knowing that Richmond were going to go midfield at 3, which meant they could get the two of us and gave themselves the best chance to do that.
But were you, in regardless of that, were you desperate to stay in WA or were you not fussed?
I think at the time you are.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look back on your career and you would have loved the privilege to go somewhere else, whether it be for your whole career or maybe a period of time, to play in Melbourne, something I never got to experience. And to be fair to my own career, didn't get the chance to play in too many big finals and too many big games at the MCG. So you look back on that with a bit of sadness, but, you know, you're also one of those lucky ones that gets to stay in your home state. And at that stage, Fremantle were an average football team, and we got the chance as youngsters to try and grow it into something pretty special with the first final series achieved in 2003.
Yeah, just before we break, it was a different time, wasn't it? So you mentioned the Dockers had 2, 4, and 5, which is a staggering haul. But they were quite extraordinarily given a priority pick. Collingwood were too, because they won 5 games or less the year prior in 1999. So it's a generous system back in the day.
Yeah, and there was comments at the time that was the Hazelby game. Yeah. So they knew that if they got to 5, they would lose that pick. So many put 2 and 2 together with me being the potential early pick for them, that there was a bit of rhetoric around that as well.
The Hazelby Cup, as it was, the last game, which they denied they lost on purpose. They said, hey, injuries, inexperience.
Of course they did.
Yes, we're with Paul Hazelby on This Is Your Journey, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating live. So the Fremantle Dockers are only 5 seasons old when Paul Hazelby arrives to prepare for the 2000 season. That's up next.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Journey. Today's guest is former Fremantle Rising Star winner, All-Australian and now prominent media personality, Paul Hazelby. So, Paul, what did it mean when it was all said and done to get to Fremantle, to get on an AFL list for you, your family, your friends, as a high pick, and then have an unbelievably good debut year, the rising star as well. It must have been a crazy time. Happy time.
Yeah. By that stage, you just want to play because the build-up's so massive, particularly for those players like Harley Reid, who for 12 months they're spoken about. So they just want to put their craft to work. And I was the same. The pre-season was really strong. I remember picking Matthew Pavlich up from the airport for his first training session. And back in those days, it was just the youngsters got thrown in and did everything. So, you know, the weather here in Perth in November, it's quite hot. And I think it was 35 degrees. We trained at Aquinas College and I picked up Pav. He had just flown in. He wasn't really hydrated for the session. And we went for about an hour and a half and then we did six 1K time trials at the end. And
yuck.
I'm behind Matthew Pavlich, so it probably says a bit about how well I was going at the time. But I could just see the big Pav getting closer and closer to the ground. And he actually collapsed in his very first session for the Fremantle Dockers through dehydration and spent his second night essentially in Perth at the hospital. It was remarkable. I think they've now changed all the rules based on what happened way back in 1999. But Lee Brown was there, and I think there was an air of excitement around Fremantle at that stage because they're to the point where we hadn't done much in the history of our football club, and to have three youngsters come in. We all got early chances and away we went. And I think in your first year, just happy, excited, you're really blown away with, you know, who's at your football club as well. All of a sudden, Tony Modra, a guy that I idolised, you had his photos on the wall at home. Adrian Fletcher was another one. Sean McManus, Fremantle legends were at your footy club, and you can't believe that you're rubbing shoulders with them, not only on the field, but also off the field. And, you know, you're impressionable at that stage, 18, 19, going out after games, enjoying yourself. Drink cards, the left bank, all those types of things. It's just a whirlwind time in a player's career.
Oh, I can imagine it. And so round one, you mentioned Geelong playing on the great Gary Hocking, Buddha Hocking. You lose the game, but you have an extraordinary debut, 30 disposals and a goal. Your hero Tony Modra helps himself to five goals. So safe to say you weren't overawed with it then, Hayes?
No, I think given the year that I had before, like I was ready to come in and play AFL. I started on the bench in that game, but I had some really good performances throughout the pre-season. And as I said, yeah, Gary Hocking was my matchup for most part of that game and just loved it. We didn't get the result, but, you know, as a youngster, you want to win, clearly, but coming into the system and having a good debut was pretty special.
And on the flip side, was there ever early in your career here, we're not in Kansas anymore moment, that the realisation that, geez, this is a huge step up in strength, power, speed, skill and all the rest of it?
Yeah, I think by about round four, I'd started really well, and then you take on the Bombers. And at that stage, they were a powerful team through 2000 and 2001. And you had all of the backline brigade before the game come to me and try and rough me up as a youngster in the competition. So that was a bit of a challenge to work through that. And that was my part probably for the next period of time. But you get over that and the game evolves and you mature as a player as well. But I just looked at it as another challenge. How good is this that some of these big names from the Bombers are spending time trying to put me off my game early in a contest?
So that's Hardwick. That's Dean Wallace played in that game. Dean Solomon was running around.
That's them. Yeah. Hardwick and particularly...
The Johnsons were there.
The Johnsons were there as well. And, Hardwick. Solomon, of course, then came to our football club a bit later.
He did. 2001, your second year, you played 20 times for one win. I mean, the team only won two. I think they lost their first 17 games. So we'll get to the coaching situation in a moment, but this was a real slog, 2001, Hayes.
Yeah, and it was tough for me too. I had the first year, the rising star, and then you get carried away with it. As I said before, being around that environment, for the first time, I'm 19 years of age. I've got money. I decided to do a bit of travelling at the end of the year. And just in the last game, it was actually the demolition derby. I hurt my back. So I missed most of the next pre-season. But you just think it's going to roll on because I'd had two pretty good years in football, but it didn't. And it was a massive lesson that you've got to get your head right and you can't be complacent. And unfortunately, it was too late by the time the season came because I didn't have the fitness and I had my worst season in the AFL, barring other years where I had injury. And it was tough as a team. We lost 17 in a row. And I think it was round 18, we finally got a win against Hawthorn over there at Marvel Stadium. And there was pressure on the coach. He got sacked that year as well. And when you had a good year the year prior, And when you then don't have it the second year, you do feel a bit of responsibility to your coach that you've let them down in a sense. And that was Damien Drum, who, you know, gave me a lot of freedom in my first year. But unfortunately, through my own doing, I couldn't back it up in year two.
You mentioned the Demolition Derby, round 21-2000. Where were you when it was all going down? I'm trying to picture you here. Were you running the other way?
I was in there. It was the only time I ever got fined or suspended throughout my career in that game. And I didn't do much. And to be fair, I probably should have fought the charge. But the club actually paid all the fines because we got the instruction going into that game from Damien Drum. And I remember the words, if you like to fight and if it's your go, today is the day. So he gave us the license. So when we all got suspended, yeah, absolutely. Because the build-up to this story was we lost by 117 points in the first round of 2000. Scott Cummings kicked 10 goals. I think Djakovic kicked 3 goals. And we got summons to the football club the next day at about 5:30 to go to Port Beach, We had to do SAS-style training for 2 hours. And then we went back to the footy club, did our normal day's training. And then we thought, okay, you beauty, we're over this. But then we got called back to the football club again that night at 10 p.m. And we did more SAS-style training at Monument Hill in Fremantle. So we got punished for that. And then fast forward 15 weeks, we come up against West Coast for the second time. We're down by 35. Gloves are off, line in the sand moment. Dale Kickett does what he did. And, you know, we come back from 35 and have the greatest win in Fremantle's history to that point and win by 1 point. And, you know, we certainly celebrated after that. And because I didn't play many big finals and I didn't win any finals, to be honest, that was, you know, the greatest time that I had with my team in football, actually coming together from that margin down and then beating the West Coast Eagles and then also squaring the ledger from that point on. So it was quite significant.
15-11-101 to 15-10-100 in that final game, and they absolutely crushed you in the game. It was round 6 earlier on that season. 28-10, 178-9761. And to think, Hayes, here we are in April of 2024. We make a big deal out of Sam Mitchell saying, you know, I don't even think he said bring your mouth guards to train. They just did a bit of light wrestling out on the Waverley Park surface, and here you are getting called back at 10 at night for double sessions, triple sessions at army training.
Mate, I reckon I'd be pretty good at SAS Australia because of the work that we used to do back in the day. And it was commonplace for all clubs. Every pre-season camp had some SAS component. And every time you failed, you had to do that. And even towards the end of my career, we lost a game to Melbourne. And Mark Harvey was the coach. And he summons all of us to get in the boxing ring one-on-one. And we had 3 players, including myself, that went down in the ring where a cop won. Lights were sort of out for a period of time. I'm not sure I was concussed. I played that week, but that's how brutal it was. And we now know that a lot of those rules have been changed.
No, they have been changed. You can't do that anymore. So 2001's an absolute nightmare. Damien Drum, you mentioned, he's sacked after, I think, after the 10th loss in a row. Now, Ben Allen takes over here, Paul. And I think it's fair to say, Benny, as good of a player he wasn't the warmest character. I mean, he was openly critical of the playing group. And I think after one of the losses, he says, words the effect of, there's not too many who have got a strong enough character to be here. And here you are in your second year. I mean, it must have been, geez, it's heavy stuff. It's heavy going.
Yeah, it was. But at that stage, you're looking forward to change, aren't you? Because not working, whether that's our own fault or whether you just need a change at the top and have that circuit breaker. And it did work because I think we got 2 wins after that season. And then, you know, fast forward 2 years later, we're playing finals footy. So sometimes when you're going through those tough times, people are reluctant and clubs are very reluctant to change coach. But sometimes it is the right call. And I think at that stage it was. And Ben Allen came in and tried players in different positions. And from that, when Chris Connolly came in, things started to grow.
Yeah, he said he wasn't there to take over at all. He had no ambition to be a senior coach. He was just going to go on his merry way after the interim stint was done. So Chris Connolly comes in, there is improvement. You lose that elimination final in 2003 to Essendon. But that year, you're all Australian. You have a great year. And I wanted to ask you, you played in the International Rules Series, which is now just a memory. And that year, it was at Subiaco and the G. The series was split, but the Aussies won on aggregate. What was that experience like playing with some of the biggest names in the game at that time and against international opposition?
Yeah, it was hard work, to be honest, because there was a good drinking culture back in those days. So, you know, 3, 4, 5 days out, you're having a really good time. And you're rubbing shoulders with some of those legends of the sport, which was fantastic. It was played here in my hometown, which was ideal as well. Big crowd. And those contests in those days were unbelievable, where, you know, they were so much more skilled than us, But then we would bring the game back closer together as it wore on with our fitness, because they'd all often get out to a strong lead, and then the tackling pressure that played a part, it was always close at the end of it, to the point where we couldn't split that series. And that's how it was throughout that period in those international rules contests. And to sit back here, you know, as a retired player, I am very proud of the All-Australian, and the All-Australian gave me a chance to represent my country, because back in those days, if you were All-Australian, you got a chance to be selected in the international rules. Hadn't I not have been an All-Australian, they wouldn't have selected me because of the type of player I was. They wanted guys with speed and the like. So I was very privileged at that stage to be awarded All-Australian, which gave me that accolade.
Awesome. Now, Frio's big run in your time was 2006, the march to the prelim under Chris Connolly. Now, you go down, though, in the first final, the qualifying final, I think a loss to Adelaide. The groin in the end packed it in, didn't it?
Yeah, horrible year for me when the team was winning. Unfortunately, I had osteitis pubis for the entire year, and that was quite common back in those days. And I remember about round 11, it started to come on, and you'd have the odd injection here and there to get it right. And building up to that first final, I just wanted to play, because I'd been a part of the football club for about 7 years at that point, and this was our big chance to go on and have some success. We'd beaten West Coast a couple of times that year. The team that actually went on to win the premiership. So I'm going into the first game. I remember just to get through training, I had to go off site and see the doctor to get some pain-killing injections in my groin. And I got through training. Then I got to the game, and I did the normal pain-killing injections prior to the game. And I'd have six or seven prior to the game. But I remember doing the warm-up thinking, oh, hang on, something's not right here. I'm still feeling my groins. And I tried to pull out of the game, but the AFL regulations at that point were that you couldn't do it that close to the game. So in my own mind, big final, I'm just saying I've got to do whatever it takes. And it was the worst experience I had on the football field, where every time I came to the bench, I went down into the doctor's rooms and got another injection to try and dull some of that pain that I had going through my body. And I just remember there was a photo taken within the game. I'm just emotional. I knew it was season done, because the club wasn't going to go through that again. And the team went on to the prelim final, and unfortunately I wasn't a part of it. But we were a pretty good side that year. But unfortunately, you know, it was quite eerie, because West Coast lost here against Sydney. And had they have won, we would have played them here in the prelim. And we felt like we had their measure in that year, beating them twice already.
So, gee, seven jabs over the course of that game just to try and stay out there.
Well, it was more than that by the end of it. That was
seven pre-game
to start off with. Yeah, I think I was 13, 14, 15 to try and get through that game.
And was it surgery after that season to correct?
Straight in for surgery that week.
Yeah, gee whiz. But you, physically, your groins came good after that, or they never quite the same?
No, they did, and that's why you see guys now like Elliot Yeo, who's been through this for the last 2 or 3 years. They're reluctant to actually do the surgery. But we had a few guys, I think Peter Bell might have had the same, Matthew Carr, they just got it done, and it was quite instant. You do the 8 to 12 weeks, but ready to go for the next pre-season, and that was the case for me. Came back in 2007 and had a pretty good year.
Yeah, well, because Chris Judd had surgery around that time too, and I think he's on the record as saying he never quite felt the same after that. Certainly a lot of acceleration and explosiveness had gone. But,
I didn't have much of that to start with. So.
I didn't want to say that. You're listening to This Is Your Journey. It's all thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Stick around. There's still plenty to get through with Paul Hazelby after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
It's been great to have your company here on This Is Your Journey. It's all thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934, and we've been joined today by former Fremantle star Paul Hazelby. So, Hayes, just away from the game for a moment, by the next year, 2007, obviously by now you're a big figure in the game with a pretty big profile, but something incredible, and I'd imagine really troubling, happens that year in 07. Inexplicably, Perth's biggest newspaper, The West Australian, somehow managed to print a photo of you with your private parts exposed. Now, it's July 2007. I can't even imagine your reaction at the time. How did it play out, and what are your memories of it?
So I was in Melbourne preparing for a game, and I remember just looking at my phone going, wow, 14 missed calls. That's unbelievable. I know I'm pretty popular, but 14 on the morning of a game is a bit more than normal. So it happened in the early edition of the West Australian over here, and the photos were actually taken probably 6 or 7 weeks in advance. So I remember the actual game, and I haven't told this story in the public too often, but I had split up with my partner at the time, and I was down to my worst pair of jocks, you know, the worst pair that you've got. So I wear them for the game. I get to the game, and I realise they're the worst pair. So I tie a knot in the side of the jocks. And I remember running around in the game going, hang on, it's still, you know, flapping around a little bit. So there's times in the game where I'm trying to place it back in. But I get through the game thinking, okay, got through that. Let's never have that happen again. But then 6 weeks later, those photos turn up in the paper. So that's the true story about how it come about. I must admit, I was a bit stiff when that happened.
So, hang on, you're getting ready for a game over here in Melbourne, and people are what, ringing you to say, hey, mate, this has happened and you need to be aware of it. I imagine you got sent the photos as well.
And they're laughing, like they're laughing, bursting into tears. And I'm a little bit aggrieved, to be honest. It was one of those things you sort of didn't know how to react. You're a bit ashamed and embarrassed by it. Now, over time, you know, it's quite funny and it's become a pretty good story to tell at the sportsman's nights. But at that particular time, leading into a game, you're feeling, hang on, something's gone amiss here and this shouldn't have happened. So that was in the West. And then the following week, there was the show on Channel 10 called The Panel. So the panel then played it on TV. So it's gone from being a big story over here in the West to now it's a national story. And I was actually employed to do the news with Channel 10 through that period. And we ended up having a settlement with the West Australian, but also with Channel 10, where they increased my employment, gave me a little bit more money over time, and we were able to donate some of that money to charity as well. So it worked out pretty good in the end.
Now, obviously, it's a bad blue from them, and I think in later editions, you mentioned the early edition, they blurred it out and they were able to realise the error in their ways. But so you considered suing, and in the end, just for the record, there was a settlement reached with the paper.
There was, and it was never going to go too far. It all happened pretty quickly, within 1 or 2 days, and the West Australian were pretty happy, and they did the right thing at the time. I was happy. Channel 10 did the right thing. We moved on. I continue to work with Channel 10. I still now work with Channel 10, ironically, and I still now write with the West Australian. So funny how things have a way of working out.
Geez, did word get around quick, though, just in that game you're over here for in Melbourne? Did you hear about it on the field, or is that the players weren't that cruel?
Well, I'm not sure the Victorian players would have known about it, but certainly our players did, and even the teammates coming in, because they had heard too. They'd had a lot of phone calls from their friends, and you know, everybody thought it was hilarious. But at that stage, I probably didn't think it was that funny, but you know, time, it has become a pretty good story.
I want to ask you about another big chapter in Fremantle's, I guess, history. It was Siren Gate, of course. Now, it was round 5, 2006. It was against the Saints in Launceston. Now, you're not playing in this game, so I imagine your perspective on this would be different to most. Were you there in the stands, or were you watching back home in Perth?
No, I'd stayed home with that, but clearly watching, you could see what had happened.
Yeah.
The siren had clearly gone, and you know, we felt aggrieved with that. We were in contention that year to play finals footy, but it was one of those unique circumstances that we always had confidence the AFL were going to do the right thing. And I think on the Tuesday, they reversed that decision. We haven't seen that in the history of the game, to be honest.
No, that's right. You were leading by a point at the time, but play continued with the umpire, with the siren blaring for about, I think, 10 seconds. And the Saints scored a point to tie the match, but you were later awarded the win. You know, for all the honours you've had, Hayes, you were no stranger to setbacks, particularly around injuries as well. I mentioned the groins, but the summer of 2008, you're getting ready for that season. You have a gruesome knee injury. Might have even been in Fremantle's first NAB Cup game, and it was against West Coast. It was at Subiaco. You tear the ACL, but also the MCL as well, the medial collateral ligament. This was a nasty one, wiped out your season.
Yeah, that one hurt. As we said, I had the good first year, poor second year. And then I had a good run for about 4 years. But there was a hernia that I needed an operation on. Then it was the osteitis pubis. And then I came back and I had a few personal issues throughout that year. So there were some challenges. But came back in 2008, where that was going to be my comeback year in the AFL, where I'd get back to the best heights that I'd reached. And throughout the pre-season, you know, I'd had by far the best pre-season, got to the first round of the pre-season competition. I think I had 15 disposals, 2 goals up until that point. And then all of a sudden, 2 West Coast Eagles players fall across my knee and another year's lost. And I don't think I fully got back after that to my best ability. I come back in 2009, played in 2010, but 2008, when I reflect back, if I had have had that season fully fit, I reckon that would have propelled the next part of my career where I probably would have gone a bit longer.
Yeah, well, the numbers were good in 09. I know they don't tell the full story. And in 2010, you played just about every game, I think 20 of them. Now, you did announce during that season that it would be your last, and yet, I guess there's further evidence, Hayes, that there is no sentiment in footy. Even with that as the backdrop, you're overlooked for finals. I think Mark Harvey's the coach at this stage.
Yeah, that was hard. At the end of 2009, I did look at leaving the football club, and I did have some meetings too at the end of 2007 when Chris Judd actually left to go to the Carlton Football Club. Stephen Ick, who was our football boss, had gone to Carlton. So there was some interest both times in 7 and 9 to go to that football club.
And from the Blues.
To the Blues, yeah. And I knew that Mark Harvey was going in a different direction with myself. And I had a meeting with him and I just wanted him to give me the answers and tell me that I was loved. And I'm not sure I actually got that from the meeting, but I think at that stage I was probably too frightened to leave the football club. I was too comfortable here in the West and I ended up staying. And I think my card was marked going into that season, particularly as a midfielder. That's where I cut my teeth. I spent most of the time in that season playing as a small forward. And, you know, it was a tough time. There was defensive pressure was becoming big in the game at that time. And I was spending so much of my energy trying to do the right thing for the team that it made it hard to actually, you know, impact the game offensively. And I think by, you know, halfway through the year, I'd had enough. I was exhausted. I was fighting for the love of the coach every single week. And I knew that I wasn't going to get back to the midfield. And it was just a matter of time until another player went past me. So announced the retirement. And, yeah, it was disappointing towards the back end of the year not to play finals. But in all honesty, you know, I think I was done by that time. The fire had gone out under Mark Harvey. And it's not Mark Harvey's fault. We've since spent a fair bit of time together. It's just that's how it works sometimes with the cycle of football clubs, that they move on, they bring in youngsters. And at that stage, it was Dave Mundy spending more time in the midfield. It was Michael Barlow spending more time in the midfield. You understand it when you get out of the game and you go into the media and coaching. But at the time, it was hard to take.
No, I can imagine. I can imagine. Also off the field, at the time, I think, so Lifeline WA, One Life, I guess the suicide prevention cause, that was something that was really close to your heart down the years?
Yeah, it was. I lost a family friend when I was a youngster, so never really understood it. And then I was approached to do some talks around this here in WA. And I think through that time where I had some tough personal issues going back to 2007, that I was in a good position to be able to speak and offer something that to the community, for people to see some rawness and some vulnerability from somebody that they watched on TV every single week. And I was able to travel around the state, go to schools with that message, the mining companies as well, at the end of my career. And it was a very special time before I found my way into coaching and then eventually media once again. But I was privileged to be able to be in that position and have people listen to my message.
Paul Hazelby, thanks so much for joining us today, mate. More than 200 games of consistent high performance, a resume that, let's be honest, the vast majority of players would take. It was a fine playing career. Well done on everything you achieved, and it's great you're still involved here at SEN. Thanks for sharing some of your story with us.
Thank you, Sam. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to This Is Your Journey. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives, you can jump online to find them at tobinbrothers.com.au. And we'll catch you the next time we celebrate another great sporting journey.